This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey. The search for more than 150 missing residents of a Florida building that collapsed 2 days ago is growing increasingly desperate Saturday as a smoldering fire hampers rescue efforts, and officials say they have not located any signs of life in the mountain of debris. A newly released 2018 report showed that an engineer found evidence of major structural damage beneath the pool deck and in the underground parking garage of the 12-story condo building 3 years before it collapsed without warning on Thursday as most residents slept. Search and rescue teams have not found any additional survivors or recovered any more bodies as of Saturday morning, according to Miami-Dade's mayor. Despite around-the-clock work at the site in Surfside, a shore town near Miami, officials claim there is still hope some of the 159 people still unaccounted for might be found alive, but acknowledge a fire somewhere beneath the rubble has slowed rescue teams. The death toll, officially at 4, is certain to rise, with each floor of the high-rise stacked atop another like pancakes. Aided by dogs, cameras, sonar, and heavy equipment, rescuers are looking for any spaces that may have formed in the debris, leaving possible survivors air to breathe. The Colombian government said Saturday it is offering a reward of nearly $800,000 for information leading to the capture of those behind an attack Friday on a helicopter carrying President Iván Duque near the Venezuela border. A reward of up to 3 billion pesos is being offered for information leading to those responsible for this terrorist attack, Defense Minister Diego Molano said in a video posted to social media. The president's helicopter was approaching an airport when several shots, apparently from rifles, were fired at it. Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Britain on Saturday recorded its most new coronavirus infections since February. Government figures show another 18,000 people tested positive for the virus across the UK, the highest daily number since February 5th. Over the past week, nearly 100,000 have tested positive, about a 50% increase compared to the week before. The Delta variant, which was first identified in India and is considered by government scientists to be between 40% to 80% more transmissible than the previous dominant strain, accounts for nearly all the new cases in Britain. Most of the new confirmed cases are among younger age groups, which have yet to receive COVID-19 vaccines. Meanwhile, Health Secretary Matt Hancock resigned Saturday after breaking social distancing rules with an aide he was allegedly having an affair with. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson had been facing widespread calls to fire Hancock, who had apologized for breaching social distancing rules. New coronavirus infections in South Africa appear to be dominated by the Delta variant, scientists said on Saturday, as a third wave sweeps the hard-hit African country. South Africa is the continent's worst affected nation in terms of coronavirus cases and deaths, accounting for roughly a third of confirmed infections and more than 40% of deaths. But the rollout of vaccines has been slow, with just 2.7 million administered so far out of a population of 60 million. The country's second coronavirus wave was driven by the Beta variant, first detected locally, but the Delta variant now looks to be leading new infections, specialists say. South Africa's government says a flurry of meetings will take place on Saturday and Sunday to consider measures to respond to the Delta variant and the ongoing surge in infections. The president is expected to address the nation on Sunday night. A British destroyer, which angered Russia by sailing through waters off Crimea, docked at a Black Sea port in Georgia on Saturday. Russia claims it fired warning shots at the ship and later threatened to bomb British naval vessels in the Black Sea if there was further, quote, provocative actions off Crimea, which Russia annexed from Ukraine in 2014. Russia also claims it dropped bombs in the path of the destroyer on Wednesday as it was passing by Crimea in what Moscow considers an incursion into Russian waters. But Britain says it sailed through waters belonging to Ukraine and that any shots fired had been part of pre-announced Russian gunnery exercises. It disputes the Russians and says no bombs were dropped. You can find more on these stories and the rest of the day's news at voanews.com. You can also follow us on the VOA mobile app. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
This judge has done a good job, has delivered a just judgment, not because he's trying maybe to please the opposition, no, but because these people were innocent from the inception.
A Tanzanian court overturns the conviction of Freeman Mbowe, chairman of the main opposition party, Chadema.
It was supposed to have been ready by the time the elections parliament began, but there were adjustments to the plan. And now that caused delays, that get clearance from several organs of government. And you know, the procurement system is a bit laborious, that it delays many projects.
The Ugandan parliament announces plans to close its doors for 2 weeks, beginning Monday.
Start our work as far as boundary delimitation, voter registration, national cards registration, because we believe that the elections are not a day's activity, but a process, and that every other process in the electoral process is important and contributes ultimately to the outcome of the election.
And a research by a Zambian consortium of faith-based organizations shows the police disproportionately disrupt or attack campaign rallies of the political opposition. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema, says it has been vindicated following a ruling by a high court in the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam, Friday. The court overturned the conviction of Freeman Mbowe, chairman of the opposition party. A magistrate court in Kisutu convicted Mbowe and seven other opposition figures of using inciting language as well as organizing and participating in an illegal gathering. They were slapped with a $150,927 fine or 6 months in jail. But in overturning the conviction, the High Court demanded the monies to be refunded to Mbowe and his colleagues. Hailing the High Court's ruling, John Malia, Chadema's head of legal affairs, says the charges against the opposition figures were politically motivated. He argues the charges were part of an effort to intimidate and weaken the opposition in the run-up to the last elections. He tells me that the opposition figures should not have been charged or even convicted, since, he contends, they were carrying out political activities protected by the Constitution.
Receive judgments with happiness and joy. And after 5 years of persecution and darkness in Tanzanian democracy, this judgment is received with happiness, not because these people who are convicted are now set free and the conviction is set aside and that the money that they paid as fine is returned, but because there's a wording of the judgment and the entire pretext of the judgment sets a very strong, in my opinion, a very strong foundation in building democracy and the electoral justice of Tanzania. In this appeal, Peter Kibatala was the lead counsel, is the one who did the appeal. I was just watching brief from far, but as you say, these are my friends and my colleagues in the party and in democracy in this country. The judge said in his judgment that words that were spoken a day before election cannot form criminal action in our country, because if a leader is saying, for instance, that as a country, as a people, we are ready to do anything to protect our democracy, that cannot be translated as the incitement. And that is the purpose of having multiple democracy. So in my opinion, the judgment, the wording of the judgment as a whole, set a very strong foundation for democracy in this country.
Well, John, I understand the judge made some comment following his ruling. What does this signify?
The comment in the judge's ruling signifies end of an era where democracy is not respected, where the police are being used to suppress opposition political parties in the country. And actually, they come at a time where we have a new president who is only 100 days in office now. And as you said herself, Honorable Samia Suluhu Hassan, that she want to increase the democratic space of the country, and maybe she'll meet with all of opposition parties and discuss on how best we can work together to increase the level, the degree of democracy in the country. So this judgment comes at a time which is needed most, and we are very thankful that it has come the way it has come.
Well, some analysts are saying the ruling today shows or demonstrates the independence of the judiciary. Is that your stance as well?
Yes, judicial independence is something that needs to be measured from different parameters, one of them being a judgment like this one. So as far as today's judgment is concerned, I'll say the judge independently decided and applied law as required by the Constitution and as mandated by the laws of this country. So I would say yes. We are now seeing and sensing some independence in the judiciary, and I think being a pillar of democracy, it is very important that the courts of Tanzania keep on being independent and abide to the law as it is, to the just laws.
John, some analysts are suggesting that because the political climate seemed to have improved, or the new president has taken a different path in how she sees the opposition, that might have influenced, although maybe not significantly, the ruling of today. What do you say to that?
Well, on that, it's not true. I want to believe, and I believe that the Honorable Judge was not interfered by the current regime at all. He was independent, and our clients were innocent throughout. What they did was only conducting political rallies and nothing, anything like an offense. So this judge has done a good job, has delivered a just judgment, not because he's trying maybe to please the opposition, no, but because these people were innocent from the inception.
John Malia is Chadema's head of legal affairs. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. A legal advisor for Libya's National Army, led by General Khalifa Haftar, has welcomed as a step in the right direction calls by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken for the full implementation of the country's ceasefire agreement. Salah Eldin Andel Karim al-Shokri also says Mr. Blinken's additional statement for all foreign forces to be withdrawn demonstrates Washington's commitment to ensuring peace in Libya. His remarks come as Blinken attended another round of UN-backed Libya peace talks in Berlin, Germany. Countries present at the meeting include Russia, Turkey, France, and Egypt. Shokri says the North African country's security challenges can be attributed to foreign forces, some of whom he says include terrorists. He tells me that failure to ensure the removal of all foreign fighters will undermine local and international efforts to ensure Libya's peace and stability.
We see this as a very good sign, because Mr. Blinken, Secretary of State of the United States, have at least be more clear on this issue, and which is exactly our stand on the foreign forces and mercenaries on the Libyan soil. We have asked for their eviction for a long time, and we hope the other side on the Libyan equation would agree with the Mr. Blinken's point of view.
What are your expectations following the call by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken regarding the ceasefire agreement in Libya, which he says must be fully implemented?
This is also a very great sign that the United States of America is looking for peace and tranquility and ceasefire on the Libyan soil. That will never happen unless the foreign terrorist mercenaries and the Turkish forces and any other force on the Libyan soil should be evicted. Otherwise, I don't see any possibility of long peace on the Libyan soil, because most Libyans would give a chance for peace. But if it doesn't happen, I know they will do their best to get all these foreign forces out of Libya.
Mr. Blinken is taking part in the second round of UN-sponsored Libyan peace talks. He attends it alongside representatives from Russia, Turkey, France, and of course, Egypt. What is General Haftar's expectations of the second round of peace talks?
Well, he supported fully, you know, the Berlin 2 round of peace talks. We have supported it since its first meeting, the Berlin first round of talks, peace talks, which is have agreed on the 5+5 military committee on the military unification issues and peace and withdrawal of foreign mercenaries and forces. General Marshal, Field Marshal Khalifa Haftar have done all his best to take the issue of the Libyan peace to its full agreements. And we hope now that will not be a third round Berlin talks after a year or so. We hope the this peace talks would be the final one and would be forced by the International Security Council and the United States and Russia and all other participants of this round of peace talks.
But meanwhile, General Haftar has closed the border with Algeria after major deployment of his forces to the south, underscored what some people said his continued rule despite effort to unify the country. So people see him as a problem. So what was the rationale behind his decision to close the border with Algeria?
Well, you know that the southern west part of Libya have been since 2011 a large area of terrorist activities, especially Boko Haram and the Algerian terrorist followers of Mukhtar, the terrorist, famous terrorist, and a lot of Hamas terrorists have been training there, especially at the Huruj Mountains, was very close range to the Algerian borders, and their supplies and their livelihood come through the oases there.
Salah Eldin Aldo Karim Al-Shokri is a legal advisor for Libya's National Army, led by General Khalifa Haftar. He spoke with me from an undisclosed location in Libya. The Ugandan parliament is monitoring the situation on the ground as the country battles the latest wave of coronavirus infection in the East African country. This after parliament announced the lawmaking body will be closed for 2 weeks beginning Monday. The closure, officials say, will serve as a precautionary measure due to reports of a surge in the infection rate of the coronavirus. Local media reports that lawmakers and parliamentary staff have tested positive to the disease.
The government has also imposed a 45-day lockdown as part of its measures to limit the spread of the disease. This, as President Yoweri Museveni declared Friday a public holiday to pray for healthcare workers. For more about the decision to close parliament, I reach Chris Obori, Communications Director for the Ugandan Parliament.
The real thing is that there is a break for 2 weeks. And this decision was informed by the current wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, which is causing a lot of problems in the country. Previously, Parliament had got three national functions. That was the election of the Speaker, the State of the Nation address by the President, and the budget. In all of those functions, all attendees in and outside Parliament had to go through a COVID test. Many of them were symptomatic, but a few of them were found to be positive, and they were not allowed to attend the functions. They went for isolation, some good treatment, and so far healed. But the wave still aggressive in the country, and the Parliament on a daily basis hosts at least 1,000 people. We have 200 journalists, over 200 daily coming to Parliament. We have members of Parliament. We have the staff. We have guests. We have the police, the security. So given the context of the current wave, Parliament thought it necessary to take a break.
Chris, my question is, what informed the decision for the 2 weeks window? Shouldn't it be more? Some are arguing that it should be more because of the wave that a country is experiencing from this global pandemic.
Precisely that. We wanted to have it more, but you know, it is a new parliament. Most of the activities have not yet been concluded. We have not yet formed the committees of parliament. So without committees of parliament, it means parliament is not fully constituted. So the pandemic is an inconvenience to the normal operations. It is why we say let the MPs disperse first for 2 weeks. As we monitor together with Ministers of Health the spread of the pandemic, then where need be, members can be called back to handle a particular business that affects the country. And again, go back as we monitor how the disease is being handled. We couldn't go for longer because cabinet has just been formed and the parliamentary committees have not been executed. The government chief whip and opposition chief whip have to nominate their members to committees of parliament. That will mean parliament will be fully constituted. But before we do that, the pandemic is threatening and parliament has to take action to help the country fight this. It's difficult to keep bringing over 1,000 people on daily basis to one institution when actually the spread is threatening the country. That's why we decided to say, let's have a 2 weeks break and monitor what happens. If we see numbers coming down, then we can, depending on the business that will be required, we can call Parliament back to that business while cognizant of the fact that COVID is a really threat to the community, a threat to the country.
There were reports of some of the newly elected members of Parliament not having offices or their offices not being ready. How is Parliament addressing that issue?
Oh, yeah. The issue of offices for members of Parliament has been a long-standing problem. In the long term, Peter, we are constructing new chambers. We expect it to be finished to create more room for members and the offices. But we have been hiring offices for them. We have hired ad offices. The contract for occupancy of the new hired premises begins on the 14th of July. So all members will be provided with accommodation. For now, the space that has been available before the increase of numbers is not enough for them. Parliament thought ahead to hire only the contracts begin next month. The long term is we are constructing the new parliamentary chambers together with offices to run away from rent.
How long will it take for the construction to be completed?
In the initial plan, it was supposed to have been ready by the time the 11th Parliament begins. But there were adjustments to the plan. And now that caused delays. We had to get clearance from several organs of government. And you know, the procurement system is a bit laborious that it delays many projects.
Chris Obori is the communications director for the Ugandan Parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In Burundi, Amnesty International is welcoming the sharp reduction in the prison sentence of Germaine Rukuki, a human rights defender. This after an appeals court reduced the prison sentence of Rukuki from 32 years to one. The Burundian human rights defender was convicted of charges including participating in an insurrectional movement, threatening internal state security, attack on the authority of the state, and rebellion. But in its ruling, the appeals court overturned the charges except that of the rebellion. The international rights group says it is hopeful the charge of rebellion would soon be overturned as well. Rachel Nicholson is Amnesty International researcher on Burundi. She tells me that Germaine Rukuki should not have been in prison for defending the right of citizens.
So as Amnesty International, we're obviously really pleased with the news that Germaine Rukuki's prison sentence has been reduced. He's been in prison, in jail now for almost 4 years on what we believe are completely trumped up charges, just on account of his human rights work. So, you know, we're thrilled that his sentence has been reduced, and that should mean that he should be released very soon. You know, we're obviously disappointed that only three of the four charges against him were quashed. So we really, you know, believe that the final charge also needs to be overturned. But in general, this is really a step in the right direction, and this is what we've been campaigning for many years. Amnesty supporters have been campaigning in their hundreds of thousands for his release. So we're really pleased.
But Rachel, supporters of the government are saying that Mr. Rukuku participated in an insurrection movement, threatened internal security, and attacked on the authority of the state. And they stand by these charges, that accusations that they are politically motivated or trumped up are just a way of trying to wash away or whitewash his image, and that he committed these acts. That is why he was charged and convicted of them. How do you respond to that?
Well, the Court of Appeal, in its ruling, found that those accusations of participating in an insurrectional movement, threatening state security, and attacking the authority of the state were unfounded. So the appeal court would beg to differ, and they've overturned that conviction. We would, you know, our concern is that human rights work in Burundi over the course of the past 5 or 6 years has been increasingly criminalized. So working for, you know, those who work for human rights organizations have really faced serious reprisals and harassment over many years. And this was one of the most egregious examples of his sentencing to 32 years in prison. We hope that the overturning of this sentence would be the start of an opening up of civic space, but we really have to wait and see what happens next.
Rachel, his conviction for rebellion was upheld by the court. Some of the defenders of the government say this shows that even in spite of the other three charges being dropped, this Mr. Rukuku committed an act against the state and has to be dealt with. The reduction of the sentence, however, shows, they say, that the government is respecting human rights and those who defend human rights. What's your response to that?
It's a good sign that the sentence has been reduced, but there are real concerns about accountability for human rights violations in Burundi more generally. You know, this is one good step, but we do need to see a sea change in Burundi to really see an end to impunity for the sort of human rights violations, you know, really serious human rights violations we've been witnessing over several years, including, you know, enforced disappearances, extrajudicial executions, torture, arbitrary arrests. You know, all of this in general goes by without any accountability. So that's why we want to see a real major change. If the government of Burundi says that they respect human rights, that's one way that they can demonstrate that they really do respect human rights, by really making a move towards greater accountability.
Well, some people are suggesting that there has been an improvement in the respect for human rights since the installation of the president last year, and that the European Union now considering reviewing or lifting sanctions on Burundi. It's a right step. As a researcher, what is your take on these developments?
So there have been some positive steps, as we acknowledge. You know, we would acknowledge that the reduction of Germaine's sentence is a positive step towards, you know, respect for human rights, We've also seen the reopening of media houses that have been closed down, NGOs that have been closed down. We've also seen the release of other human rights defenders and journalists. And those are important steps, but they're not enough. Like I said, these are important steps, but we want to see much more deep-rooted change, much more deep-rooted reform to ensure that members of the youth wing of the ruling party, the Imbonerakure, members of the security services, are not allowed to act with impunity. And we've not seen actions yet going deep enough to really change that level of impunity that Burundi is still experiencing.
Rachel Nicholson is Amnesty International's researcher on Burundi. She spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Zambia, the latest report released from the Christian Churches Monitoring Group, or CCMG, a consortium of faith-based organizations, shows the police disproportionately disrupt or attack campaign rallies of the political opposition, including the main critic, the United Party for National Development, or UPND Alliance. The research cited incidents of the police disrupting political activities for unspecified reasons since official campaigning began in the run-up to the August 12 general election. Representatives of the UPND and other groups say they are vindicated by the CCMG's research finding. They accuse the police of bias in doing the bidding of the ruling party, an accusation the police deny. The parties are calling for an even playing field to ensure the upcoming elections are peaceful and credible. This as Zambians go to the polls in August to choose a new president and parliament. Peter Mwanangombe, the programs manager at the Christian Churches Monitoring Group, or CCMG, says its officials will soon meet with the police to discuss the findings of the study. He tells me that the police need to correct the identified challenges in the report to ensure better policing during the election period.
Yes, this is something that we've been trying to track for a long time now through our 330 observers that we have in the field. And so what we are really looking for is to see how effective and equitable the police is able to provide security for different political parties. But what we note is that there is very little security that is provided to, you know, the opposition, particularly the UPND. But where police are actually involved in violence, they are seen to have, you know, been targeting the opposition. So that is exactly what our findings are showing.
Will you share this data with the police so that they can actually correct some of these incidents?
Absolutely. You might want to note that actually prior to releasing that data, while it was still being compiled, we did write to the police seeking a meeting with them and to discuss some of the findings that we had. But unfortunately, we've not had an opportunity to meet because they had to reschedule a meeting. However, what CCMG does is that every time we release such a report, we print a copy for them and deliver a hard copy to their headquarters in Lusaka. So we really are looking forward to having a conversation with the police about this because we believe there is an opportunity to actually correct such things.
Since this report came out, some of these political parties, including the UPND, say they are vindicated because they've been expressing concern about unfair policing and unduly being targeted by the police, saying the police does the bidding of the UPND. Some supporters of the ruling party are also accusing your organization that you are biased in this report. How do you respond to such criticism?
You know, we go through a very rigorous process of verifying incidents. So it's not just what we see on social media, but it's what people in the on the ground are actually observing. And it's not surprising that you have two sides, one that is saying they've been vindicated and one which is saying we are biased. And so we expect such sentiments. But over and above all, I think police conduct in as far as policing elections leaves much to be desired, especially as it relates to them being able to be professional towards the opposition. And it doesn't only mean UPND in this case as opposition. It's many others, and I'm sure as we go on, we'll be able to see some of these instances actually extending to other political parties.
Peter, what necessitated this research by the Christian Churches Monitoring Group?
The Christian Churches Monitoring Group is founded on the premise that they would like to see transparent, inclusive, and credible electoral processes, and not just election day. And so we've decided to embark on a comprehensive observation of the entire electoral cycle. So if you look at our reports, we start our work as far as boundary delimitation, voter registration, national cards registration, because we believe that the elections are not a day's activity, but a process, and that every other process in the electoral process is important and contributes ultimately to the outcome of the election.
Peter Mwanangombe is the program's manager at the Christian Churches Monitoring Group, CCMG. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Mauritania, supporters of former President Mohamed Ould Aziz say the treatment being meted out to him by the current administration is unfortunate and regrettable. This after the former president was jailed on Tuesday. The remark comes after the former president refused to report to the police as part of the conditions for his house arrest. Among the charges the former president faces include graft, illicit enrichment, and money laundering. But Mr. Aziz and his supporters reject the charges as politically motivated. They say it appears the administration wants to prevent the former president from participating in politics. For more reaction about the circumstances that led to the jailing of former Mauritanian President Mohamed Ould Aziz, I reached Sidi Ahmed, a political activist who supports the former president.
Myself and most of the Mauritanian citizens were really shocked by the news that the former president had been jailed. And mostly it's illegal. I mean, the circumstances that has led to him being stopped in jail, it's illegal. And we are just waiting for the upcoming days to see what this jail will reveal about his future. And most of the politician activists who are watching the scene from a close point of view. First of all, he's a Mauritanian citizen after all. He is accused with some accusations. And the proof is not yet even given to the court.
Sidi, the government insists he broke the law. He violated the constitution for which he's been prosecuted. So why are you saying it is illegal?
Because we all know that the circumstances around the judiciary system in Mauritania, it's not fair, and it lacks the to be independent. And how come these are the same people who were working with him during his reign, during his first reign and second reign? And if he to be jailed, they all have to be in the same bin. I mean, sorry for the word, but for them and for him to be accused, it's illegal, because the reason behind him being jailed is that he just preferred to come to prove that he's still in Mauritania. He preferred to come on foot, and during that process from point A to point B, from his house to the courtyard, people sometimes followed him, I mean, intentionally, because his supporters and they are trying to show intimacy and trying to show their support to him. And that has urged the government to ban him from working from home to the court. Instead, they suggested to send him a car with an officer to take him, to pick him and bring him back. That's refusing, because he said it's a personal freedom. He's free. What matters is that he come in his line as a proof that he's still in Mauritania. And even him being in a house arrest, not able to go around or to do anything, this is also illegal. Yes.
Basidi, the former president served 2 full year terms in office, as allowed by the constitution. People said they expected him to be a statesman and not to engage himself in the day-to-day political activities in Mauritania, which he obviously wants to continue to do. That is what some people are saying is the genesis of all his problems. How do you respond to that?
It's personal freedom. He preferred to serve his country from a near point. I mean, he preferred to stay in his country and to continue what he did, and from another perspective, not as a man in power. I think this is a personal freedom, and he has all the right to practice politics and to support whoever he wants to support. And what the person or the party who he is supporting, they might elect him as a president. What's in that? The law says only that you have to serve only 2 terms and not avoid politics after being elected into mandate, okay? So this is, he's doing only his rights as a Mauritanian citizen.
Some supporters of the government are saying the former president has himself to blame for breaking the law, and that breaking the law has consequences. He broke the law, so he must pay for it. And that is why he's in jail, because he had a defense in court and his defense lost. That is why he is in jail. How do you respond to that?
Well, these people, for them, I have one question. Which law did he violate? Which law? We all know that the law and the judicial court and the judicial system itself is not independent in our country, and nothing is independent. So which law did he really violate? And which law did he really broke? And his defense did not lost the allegation inside the court.
Sidi Ahmed is a political activist who supports the former Mauritanian president. He spoke with me from the Mauritanian capital, Nouakchott. Hollywood actress and special envoy for the UN Refugee Agency, Angelina Jolie, is praising Burkina Faso's efforts in helping people displaced by Islamic militants. But rights activists say Burkinabe authorities have also been fueling the conflict by detaining hundreds of people without charge, including IDPs, and also by extrajudicial killings. For VOA, Henry Wilkins reports from the Gudubu refugee camp.
Deep in Burkina Faso's war-torn Sahel province lies the Gudubu refugee camp. It was rebuilt after Islamist militants burnt much of it to the ground last year. Around 11,000 refugees live here in makeshift tents or plastic flat-pack shelters provided by the United Nations. They fled Mali, a country plagued by armed groups linked to the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda terror groups, to another country beset by the same problem. Hollywood actress Angelina Jolie, who's special envoy for the UN's refugee agency, UNHCR, recently visited Gudubu to mark World Refugee Day and praised Burkina Faso for its treatment of the displaced.
The truth is, we are not doing half of what we could and should to find solutions to enable refugees to return home or to support host countries like Burkina Faso, coping for years with a fraction of the humanitarian aid needed to provide basic support and protection.
Her visit took place in the country's only major refugee camp. Official sites for the country's 1.2 million internally displaced people, IDPs, are off limits to the media due to a government ban. Burkina Faso is one of the world's most neglected humanitarian crises, according to the Norwegian Refugee Council, and the West African country is struggling both to prevent terrorist attacks and protect IDPs. But its security forces have been accused by a local human rights group, the Collective Against Impunity and Stigmatization of Communities, of atrocities against IDPs. A victim of one attack described watching his friends being killed in front of him by security forces. We've withheld the name of the survivor for his safety. He says security forces gathered up all the young people, then burned everything, houses as well as crops. Then they took 2 people away and shot them dead. Another person was beaten to death right next to him, just a few feet away. Human Rights Watch says abductions and extrajudicial killings of civilians are common in Burkina Faso.
Since 2019, Human Rights Watch has documented over 200 cases of extrajudicial killings by Burkinabe armed forces in the context of counterterrorism operations. This is an extremely worrying trend, which feeds, of course, in recruitment efforts by armed Islamist groups.
IDPs live in constant fear, says the UNHCR.
In the conflict-affected areas of the Sahel, communities literally live with the fear of the next attack, and that's what's driving up the number of people forcibly displaced. And with that, of course, comes higher needs for basic humanitarian services.
Burkina Faso's defense ministry did not respond to requests for comments on the accusation of extrajudicial killings and abductions. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Gudubu Refugee Camp, Burkina Faso.
COVID-19 cases are rising in Zimbabwe, and some public hospitals have resorted to only treating emergency cases to make room for a growing number of infected patients. For VOA, Kutai's Vanavashi reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Officials say that the number of people infected with the coronavirus is on the upswing. Monica Mutswangwa is the Minister of Information.
Cabinet noted with concern that the surge reported the previous week continues, with a total of 1,339 cases recorded during the period under review, comparing to 544 reported the previous week.
Because of this increase, the government has resorted to introducing lockdowns in local areas.
This represents a 127% increase. The majority of cases were recorded in Murungwe, that's about 364 in Murungwe, 217 in Kariba, 185 in Tirezi, 51 in Makonde. Health authorities have designated these areas hotspots, and localized lockdowns have been declared in Murungwe and Kariba. The surge is mostly attributable to the general complacence in adhering to the state COVID-19 preventive and precautionary measures, both in communities and at workplaces.
Medical expert Dr. Tinashe Gede questions the effectiveness of the localized lockdowns.
The biggest problem is that by the time you start getting symptomatic cases, there's often been transmission happening probably a week or two before that. So in a situation where people are very mobile, before you even know that there's an infection in, say, in Mondoro or some other place, by the time you turn up and ring fence and lock down Mondoro, there's a good chance that whatever infection are trying to contain in that community may have spread beyond.
He says that is the reason why the number of hotspots keeps increasing. Denford Mutashu is the president of the Confederation of the Zimbabwe Retailers. He says his group is calling for a national lockdown.
There is the general complacence in respect of compliance with the COVID-19 protocols, and it is even dangerous as the country braces for the third wave, which, if you look across the border, is ravaging. It is imperative that we remain alive and cognizant to the fact that the pandemic is actually rearing its ugly head again. Without any strict, we may also face similar challenges. We need to be proactive and ensure that there is compliance on social and physical distancing, wearing of masks.
The public has met the calls for a nationwide lockdown with resistance. Some complain that businesses and traders lost a lot of money during the previous widespread shutdown. Particularly hit, businessmen say, was the tourism industry, which is still struggling to recover from the initial lockdown last year. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunavashe from Harare.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
You giving me head sweat. Baby,
Your body daily, hey. Now baby you me party now, hey, hey. Your body give me shell, hey. Your body give me quelle. Let me give you all my love, love. Let me give you all my time, time. Let me treat you like my own baby.
See.
شفتش حد جميل وتقيل كده استاذ فنان دكتور مدرسه فن وهندسه ايه كل ده بقى درجي حلنجي ومزاجنجي بس جد ومش كلامنجي ده فدني هواسني تعبني مريحني واشواقك مرجحني
was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Bill Eagle, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, in a village where people are not disciplined, whips grow everywhere as plants, and people even use them as pillows. I'm your host, Peter Clotin, Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.